Today is Thursday, March 23rd, the year 2000. We're here in East Lansing. I'm Jeff Charnley interviewing Dr. Richard Sullivan for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution to be commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, Dr. Sullivan, we're taping this interview today. You give us permission to tape?
Right.
Okay. I'd like to start first with a little bit about your general background, education and professional background. Well, where were you born? And
I was born in Nebraska, Doniphan, Nebraska, in 1921, so I've been around for some time. I went to the University of Nebraska as an undergraduate, and then I was in the Air Corps for 4 years during World War II. Then I went to University of Illinois and got a master's and PhD. And my first teaching job was in 1949 at Northeast Missouri State College, a teacher's college in Kirksville, Missouri. '54, I came to Michigan State. Been here since.
What year did you graduate with your bachelor's degree?
In '42.
In '42.
Yes.
And then you went directly in the...
Directly into the Army and was in the Army until '46.
Did you serve overseas?
No, I didn't. I served in the United States all the time.
I see. So after the war was over and you got out of the service, did you use the GI Bill?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I went directly out of the service into the University of Illinois graduate program.
Yeah. What was the University of Illinois like at that time in graduate work?
Well, it was a very good university, at least I thought it was. It had a very strong history department, which is particularly attractive. I'd been stationed at Chanute Field, which is right next door to Urbana. So I got involved with people there before I was out of the Army, and so I got acquainted with some of the teachers and professors. And one particular one was I was very attracted to because I was in medieval history, and he was interested in my working with him. And so that's how I got involved at the University of Illinois.
What sparked your interest in medieval history?
Well, yes, it was a teacher I had when I was an undergraduate at the University of Nebraska who got me very excited. I was interested in history when I went to the University of Nebraska, but this particular teacher particularly excited me, and so I followed up that. I was lucky in high school. I went to a very small and very limited high school, but I learned to read Latin while I was there. And so when I got to the University of Nebraska, medievalists were interested in me because I could read Latin, one of the few people around that could. And, so this was a kind of a fluke in my life that, in a sense, determined what my career turned out to be.
Interesting. The and then at the and who'd you study with at the University of Illinois?
Charles Odegaard was his name. He later became dean at the University of Michigan and president of the University of Washington for many years.
Did your dissertation work require any travel or overseas study or anything like that?
No, I did my dissertation really out of the published sources.
I see.
But I did go to Europe immediately. I won a fellowship when I finished my degree. I went to Europe for 6 months, kind of seeing the medieval sites and doing some wrap-up ends on my dissertation, but it was already finished and my degree had been awarded at that time.
On that first trip to Europe, what do you remember? What stands out most about that trip?
I guess I really felt for the first time how much greater impact the war was on Europeans than it was on we Americans, although many people were there during the war, but I wasn't. But Europe was still a very depressed place, and you know, there was a shortage of food, shortage of fuel, almost anything you can think of. So that impressed me. But just to be in Europe after growing up in Nebraska was, you know, that is what really impressed me, I guess. And I was able to travel around a good bit. I went all over Europe, really, during that 6 months. And so got to see a lot of things that I'd read about over the years. Now I got to see them at first sight.
So what year was that?
That was from 49.
49, okay.
I got my degree in March, in the end of the first semester, in the spring of 49. Then I went to Europe for 6 months, came back, and in the fall took a job then, my first job.
Okay. The so then you were assistant professor at at Southwest Missouri State?
Northeast Missouri.
All right.
I was an assistant professor, but I was there 5 years, and I got to be a full professor during that time.
And what courses were you teaching there?
Well, the big load was the Western Civ course. I taught huge classes of that. But I also taught ancient and medieval history as a part of the regular history program.
How did you first hear about MSU, or how did you end up at Michigan State?
A friend of mine came through Kirksville and said that there was an opening here, so I applied for it, which is how we used to get jobs anyway. I guess my record looked good enough to somebody at least that I was invited to come for an interview, and ultimately was asked to take a job here.
Who was the chair in history then?
Walter Fee.
Okay. And he had been at Michigan State for many, many years.
Yes, he came, I suppose in the late 20s or early 30s.
You succeeded him as?
Yes, I did.
Chair?
As chair, yes.
Probably when he interviewed you, he didn't think he was interviewing his successor.
I don't think that was in the books there.
Well, if you think, so it was 1954?
54,
That you came to Michigan State. Yeah. And what were your first impressions when you came for your campus interview, what do you remember?
It was a big place, but I had been used to a big place at the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. Although I had taught at a big place, I knew what a big university was like. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it couldn't come up to the University of Illinois, and library facilities and things of that sort. When I first came here, we were just getting started to build a library. You know, we weren't even in the new building that we're in now. We were across the street where the museum is. Mm-hmm. Very small holdings. But the wonderful thing about Michigan State then was that the doors were open. You could buy what you wanted. You could order anything you wanted. And somehow there just seemed to be money every place in those days. And the history department was just building up. When I first came here, I taught both ancient and medieval history. Well, shortly after that, we hired an ancient historian and another medieval historian, and so that's the kind of thing that was going on all over the campus then.
So a lot of expansion within both the
student
body.
Yes,
the
student body was expanding, but everything else was expanding too.
What was the graduate program like when you first got here? Was it, how extensive was it? You remember?
It was not very extensive, no. A lot of people who really were involved in attracting the first graduate students came at about the same time I did, or shortly before that. So a new crowd of people had come in with opportunities to do graduate work. I don't think those had existed before. Not that people weren't competent to do it, but it just was not part of the scene here then. Who was part of the growth, you see.
Okay. Who else was part of that cohort that came in about the same time you did?
Jack Garrity and Dick Dorson and Arthur Adams, Al Glick, Fred Williams.
Paul Vard, or was he here
Paul
before?
Paul Vard came a little later than that, yes. Yeah, he came from Ohio State. He'd already established himself. He came here as a full professor.
I see.
And there was a lot of people who left in the interval who came through about that time, too. Mm-hmm. So the department was growing in numbers, and thus, likewise, it was growing in opportunities to do graduate work. That's really what happened, I think. And the university had decided that it was going to support graduate work in not only just a few disciplines like the ag establishment or the education business, it decided it was going to be a full-time university. See, we got in the Big Ten just about the same time I came here. I believe it was in 55.
Okay.
So, you know, you don't get in the Big Ten unless you are willing to have a graduate program. And so, so those were all part of what was going on at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like it for a faculty member, it was an exciting time.
It was an exciting time. It really was, yes. Mm-hmm. It's never been the same since in some ways, really, you know. Yeah. Once we began to succeed, as I think the department or the university did succeed in many ways in subsequent years, then, you know, it got to be kind of old hat and all this sort of thing. But when you were in on it at the beginning, kind of, it was something.
You arrived just the year before this, the university celebrated its centennial.
Yes.
Do you remember? I know we're focusing on 2005, and that's part of the reason why we're doing these interviews. But so you were here right at that time.
Yes,
do you remember any of the activities that the history department was involved in?
Well, I knew Madison was writing his history. That was in connection with the centennial. Mm-hmm. But I really don't remember anything. I believe it was a kind of low-key observance of our 100th anniversary, as I remember it now. Maybe I'm wrong. You may know more about that than I do.
And is what several people have said.
Really?
It was geared toward the book, and there wasn't And the Big Ten accomplishment people have mentioned?
I think to many of us, the Big Ten accomplishment meant more than 100 years in some ways.
And, I see. Let's talk about your career and your work here in developing graduate students. Any ones that you had at that time that you were obviously an important influence in their life in teaching? Who were some of those students that you had in the early years?
I remember the many of them. I think the first one was a young man named Kit Morgan, William Morgan, who came here from the University of Toledo to study with me, apparently, for some reason or other. he was really my first PhD. Another one was Jim Waltz, who came about that same time. I think he was an undergraduate student here and got acquainted with me in that respect. And then I really had, they began to be several of them, and for a while I really had quite a group of graduate students.
You remember what was the, at any point there was the largest number that you had at one time?
I suppose it was probably in the late 60s. I must have had 8 or 10 students working on PhDs about that time.
I see. Sounds like a lot of
commitment. Then I went into administration and I began not to have as much time to, although I continued to have students, but I didn't have as many as I did then, I think.
So the range of courses you were teaching, were you teaching a survey course in Western Civ,
Yes, when I first came here, strangely enough, I taught Western Civ, I taught ancient history, I taught medieval history, and I taught American history in one semester. that didn't last very long because we were getting too many students and getting more and more faculty, but I did teach American history.
And your Latin background didn't help much.
No, it didn't help much. In fact, the first day I taught American history, some student wanted to know what bore they used as some rifle in a battle in the Civil War, and I didn't know. I had no idea what he was talking about.
That's a Fred Williams question.
Fred was soon, but this was the American history survey.
The details. So the Western Civ, so you were teaching that in large classes?
Yes, we had large classes then with graduate assistants working with us. Mm-hmm. And they were really run fairly large. We had large classes in ancient and medieval history too, 100 to 120 students every term. And,
Were those required courses?
No, they weren't.
Just
they were,
in different
history
fields?
History was much more popular among students then, students who not necessarily majoring in history, I think just taking history courses. Mm-hmm. And especially, they were attracted to people who were good professors. And so we had huge classes. Some of the undergraduate classes in history were really out of hand almost.
As you think about your experience, obviously at some point you were awarded the title of distinguished professor at the university. I think it's important, in fact, in talking with faculty to ask them what do you consider your best teaching ability, or how did you deliver the history courses?
Well, I think that I was really best as a lecturer in big classes. I really do. I think that's not a popular thing to say in the day when people don't talk about big classes and so forth, but I think I could do that best. And not everybody can do that. Not everybody needs to do it. It's just some people can and some people can't. And I did fairly well in graduate classes too. I could manage that.
That both as a seminar. Type of approach. What in your early publishing and the link between your research and that went on in the 1950s? Publishing were you working on?
The first publications I had was when I was in Northeast Missouri.
Okay.
Really, they were work out of my dissertation. I published them as articles in some fairly prestigious medieval journals. I think that was one reason why I got a job here, because I had some publication record. I had some things in the mill at that time. And so I got started there. It was a kind of a struggle because I had no library facilities whatsoever there. I used to have to go to Urbana from Kirksville about four or five times a year to stock up on what I needed. And,
What'd you do when you came here? And well, you had to build the library.
We began to build a library, yes, mm-hmm. yes. It was just a matter of ordering books and getting them. That was not possible in Missouri because they just were not a research university. Mm-hmm. And, they didn't have the kind of money that it took to takes to build a library.
Mm-hmm. Your first book, when was that published?
The first book was published in 1961, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. I got a Fulbright and a Guggenheim in 1961-62, and while I was abroad in Belgium, I finished a book on Aachen, which was published before I got back, in fact. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in 1960, Professor Harris, do you remember him? Did you know him?
I didn't know him,
yeah,
but
well,
only
he
the
I
co-author.
I did a Western Civ book, which was published, the first edition of that in 1961.
61 was the first edition. Mm-hmm. Is that still in print?
I don't think it is anymore, but
okay.
it went through eight editions.
So eight editions.
It's still on sale. I still get royalty checks, but I think textbooks are kind of going out of business now because of electronic communications and so forth.
In that period from in the later 1960s, did you see much difference in terms of the students in the 60s compared to when you first got here?
Yeah, I believe it was then that I noticed students less interested in history than they had been. They were, they were beginning to sense that, or begin to talk like they sensed that the past didn't make any difference, that it was a burden on them, and so on and so forth. And so there's a kind of turning against history. If you had to teach a course where students were required to take it, as they were some courses, you got more and more resentment on the part of some students, or resistance on the part of students. And so it became, for a while at least, a little bit unpleasant to teach history, and although not intolerable, but just a little bit different. And students begin to be more critical. They begin to want to define what they wanted more and insist on getting it more. I'm not sure they knew what they wanted, but at least they mm-hmm. acted like they knew what they wanted and talked like they did, and so on. So teaching became more challenging in some ways. Some would say more difficult, but more challenging, I would prefer to put it.
Did you find students in the classroom making any connections with either what you were talking about with contemporary politics, whether the war in Vietnam or anything like that? Did you encounter that or no?
Some of that, yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Although I had always tried in all my teaching to make sure that at least, there was some reason for talking about this in this modern world. Not just antiquarianism, but there was some reason this meant something in some way. So in that sense, I guess I always was trying to connect past and present in some way. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to connect it in a different way than I did. I guess that's what I'm saying.
I see. And it was in this period you became history chair,
in 68,
right?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
1968. So yes, that was you probably remember that year.
Yes, yes. And the next that and the next couple of years. Yeah.
How was it that you became chair?
Well,
Professor Fee retired, or
he retired. Yes, okay. And the department went through a selection process, and I came out.
You came out. What else do you remember was happening at that time? With President Hanna was obviously president when you were
was beginning to be under siege by that time, and part of the trouble around here was complaints about his old-fashioned ways. I didn't agree with that, but mm-hmm. that's what people were saying. And not only students, but a lot of faculty members were saying the same thing. There were probably more radicals on the faculty than there were students on, at least on this campus. I don't know whether about all campuses or not, but
more radical faculty.
I remember one of the first things that happened when I was chair, which was would have been unthinkable earlier in my career, I guess, people refused to teach. They
Faculty members.
Yeah, faculty members. They wouldn't go into the, that was their way of protesting. To me, that just seemed, you know, intolerable. But people had reasons, I guess. And
The in some of the, in the transition to Walter Adams and Clifton Horton, did you have any dealings with them as history chair at all, or?
Well, but, I became dean the very same day, in fact, that Wharton became president, January 1st, 1970.
So you weren't chair very long in history.
Okay. No, I was only chair for really a year and a half, I guess, yeah. Okay.
So who was the, do you remember who the dean was before?
Paul Vard was.
Oh, Paul Vard,
yes,
okay.
Yes, I succeeded him. He was the first dean of Arts and Letters.
Okay.
Arts and Letters is not very old.
As it was, it was in a different organization.
It was in what they used to call the Arts and Sciences College, a huge 110 department college. So,
so you were the second in the string.
Yes, yeah.
In that one, what, in terms of administration, what did you see as maybe one of your strengths as an administrator? That you.
Well, I thought one of my strengths was I was a fairly good manager of money. I could keep track of it. So that won me some favor, in some people's eyes at least, that I always knew where the money was and didn't let people get away with it as much as they might have liked to. I hope at least that I listened to everybody that needed to be listened to as part of administering. I'm not sure I had, I have a hunch that, now that I look back on it, that some of my views about what education was and should be were maybe a little old-fashioned by that time. And so maybe I was not forward-looking enough as dean, but in a sense I was kind of traditionalist as in terms of educational policy and, you know, the code of honor that should govern the profession and so forth. I think I was a little, as I say, old-fashioned in that respect.
So you saw a difference in the work ethic of the faculty from your generation and from perhaps even newer.
Well, I guess the thing that I saw, I wouldn't say that their work ethic was the matter of issue. I think it was where they placed their loyalty, if I may call it that. It seems to me that when I first came here, people thought about, you know, doing history on this little 4 square miles. By the time I was dean, more and more faculty members were interested in where they stood in the profession, somewhere outside the, and so that gave them priorities and interests and so forth, where they spent their energy other than where I thought it should be spent or it once was spent.
So the change in the profession,
going on
at that time.
I mean, it wasn't just here, you know, this was happening all over and it's still happening, I think. I think that institutional loyalty is not very strong these times. And we're not quite as bad as professional athletes, but probably if we had enough money involved in hiring people, they'd be running one place or another just like they do now, you know.
Yeah.
Free agents.
That was one of the issues that came up in talking with Pauline Adams about on how Walter Adams, this was one of his first jobs, and the loyalty issue to the institution, the whole concept, because he could have gone in.
That's what I'm sure he had, would have had dozens of opportunities, but didn't.
In your case, did you have, were other people, headhunters coming after you?
I had, yes. Especially to administrative jobs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I was still relatively young then, so, but I always found it better here. I just was not interested, you know. I was curious, I would listen to people, but I didn't, was never very interested.
So that's why you stayed?
Well, I think I stayed because I liked it here, because the university treated me very well.
In terms of being dean and the first provost that you were working with, as dean?
The first provost was Larry Bolger.
Okay. And you were here during, as you mentioned, just during the new administration of
Cliff Horton.
Cliff Horton.
Yeah.
Did you have any dealings directly with him
Well, or yes, I did. We got to be fairly friendly on a personal basis with them. We got along very well with them. They got along very well with us, and they were wonderful people in that respect. They were very hospitable and then, of course, we got involved in the building of the Wharton Center, I was a part of that movement, and that brought us together. Mm-hmm. I was a great admirer of Cliff Wharton, I think more than a lot of other people were, but... Mm-hmm.
What would you say that he brought to this campus?
Well, I think he brought a kind of cosmopolitan flavor that perhaps was lacking in the Hammond days. And I don't mean that to be any way critical. It was just the way this university came into being and grew that made it somewhat parochial, I think. Mm-hmm. Tied to a kind of special interest in his state agricultural establishment, and it did, you know, it did yeoman work in that respect. It was a real pioneering university in terms of community service and so forth. But it left a kind of a rift in the university between that parochialism and an increasingly cosmopolitan faculty drawn into the place in the years when I came and others began to come in. And so there was a kind of tension in that respect. I think Wharton tended at least, I don't know whether he succeeded totally or not, but he tended at least to open the place up a little bit to outside influences that I think were good for the place. And you know, the idea of a Wharton Center, as I went through that matter, was really kind of... ran against the grain amongst some people. It didn't seem like that's what we should be doing. You know, much more important was the Breslin Center, what became the Breslin Center. That was the kind of thing. And Wharton, you know, stood up and said, and began to put his money where his mouth was, that we need this particular kind of facility here to make this a big-time university. And so it turned out, I think. You know. That's a kind of a symbol of what I think he stood for, this university.
The issue of support for the arts, obviously you as Dean of Arts and Letters, did you find either overt or covert opposition to that, or the role, or maybe let's talk a little bit about where you see the role of the humanities in undergraduate education. Let's start first with that.
Well, I think that, you know, by the time I came here, and certainly after I came here, there was really no question about the importance of the humanities defined in terms of traditional disciplines like history and philosophy and English and to some extent foreign languages. The support for the arts was really much less pronounced than for the humanities in general. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just appalled when I became dean at the difference between the salaries of music people and art people and those in English and history and so forth. It was just disgraceful. And
Do you remember just in terms of the specifics of proportion, was it half?
Well, I would say they were a third lower than...
Wow. Yeah. 33% lower than...
And that's just
many.
Off the top of my head.
Yeah, right. But you...
Well, Paul Vargas started this before, but we continued to finally convinced people that that was as much a part of the university as many other things, and Wharton was sympathetic to that, and John Cantlin was too when he became provost.
It seemed like hard to maintain or attract good people if they weren't paid anything.
Well, that was it was kind of amazing that we did as well as we did, especially in music, considering you know, the disadvantages they were working against. There were people around here who fully believed that music teachers didn't need as much money because they gave private lessons. You know, these people were consulting on pesticides and so on and so forth, but that was different. Yes, you know. So you know, the argument would often be, well, they're giving private lessons.
So they could sing for their supper, right?
Yeah, they could sing for their supper. That's right. Yeah.
What were there any? As you look back, any faculty members that you had, or maybe had some that you're proud of, or that, that actually you, you felt responsible of bringing them or actively seeking them out or anything like that?
There were a lot of good faculty people who were hired while I was, I think probably the one that I think most about is Ralph Vodopek.
Mm-hmm. You were dean when he was when he first came.
Yes,
When we talk about the arts and humanities within the curriculum of the university, what were there any major changes while you were dean during that time in terms of undergraduate education, or that you recall?
No, I don't think that there was anything spectacular. Okay. I suspect that we were on the way while I was dean, we began to be on the way while I was dean, to bring together the university college and the core colleges, you know, what eventually came to pass, which was something that had to be faced because it was getting to the point where it was costing us too much to really run two history departments and two literature departments and two sociology departments and so on and so forth. And so something had to be done about that. And I think that that began to be worked out while I was dean. We began to move towards some kind of consolidation of this effort.
And then ultimately that resulted in the end of University College.
End of University College, yes, and the merger of its departments into various academic departments. Mm-hmm.
And I believe ours is one of the few
few
remaining departments, right, American Thought and Language. The in dealing with the chairs of the various departments that you had to deal with, and how did you run, or let's say talk about the administrative style that you had when you were dean, how did you manage